Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. This week, some important state revenue information was released. And while some think more cuts are needed, the Speaker of the House disagrees.
You know, I think we're about done cutting.
A sexual assault survivor talks about what it was like to share her story with administrators at the University of Wyoming.
I just felt like they didn't want to have to deal with it, like they were kind of brushing it under the rug and putting it off.
And we'll look at the Interior Department's draft 5-year strategic plan.
A read through the document shows that that prioritizes oil and gas development and treats our parks and visitors as burdens.
Those stories and much more are coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. Wyoming's revenue forecasting arm, known as the Consensus Revenue Estimating Group, or CREG, had some good news for state officials. CREG says Wyoming's general fund will see an increase of $141 million from January projections. Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck reports that state lawmakers and the governor say it's good news, not great news.
The governor and the legislature used the fall CREG report to help determine how much money they will have to spend in the upcoming legislative session. Wyoming's revenues have dropped substantially in recent years, and so while this is just a modest increase, Governor Matt Mead is pleased that it's not another decline.
The revenue resembles about where we were in 2009, 2010, and so it's still not where we would like to be at all, but it's certainly a lot better news than we thought.
After massive budget cuts over the last couple of years, Mead feared that when the 2018 budget session rolled around, that the state would be facing serious cuts in education and more cuts in government. He says things have changed.
4 months ago, it looked like we were going to be $100 million short of meeting our standard budget. Now we know we're not only going to meet our standard budget with the revenue out there, we're going to have a little extra.
But it's just a little extra. In fact, when one looks at the numbers, the forecast is actually a little flat. Senate Appropriations Chairman Bruce Burns points out that legislators will still be using reserve funds to balance the budget. Burns says the long-range CREG forecast shows that revenues will not return to where they were a few years ago, so there's only one solution.
There's no question we're going to have to be cutting more to get down to what the new reality is going to be. We have the cushion of the LSRA, the rainy day account, and this latest CREG report gives us a little bit more cushion.
But here's Speaker of the House Steve Harshman.
You know, I think we're about done cutting.
Not an insignificant voice in all of this, Harshman says lawmakers have already cut a lot.
If you look at our general fund budget, it's over 13% smaller when you inflation adjust it from the 2003-04 budget. So we got one of the smallest budgets now we've had in many, many years.
Harshman says the revenue numbers tell him that large cuts to education are no longer necessary, and he thinks there are some cuts that they might want to go back and revisit.
I know there's a cut to a cervical cancer program. I just know that's going to go back in. Those things have to. I think the Department of Health, which has 40% of the state's budget, it's been cut dramatically. Care for our elderly, that's going to be the next big issue in our state in the next 10 years. So all those things, I think, folks will look at.
Senate Minority Leader Chris Rothfuss loses patience with those who want to cut more.
The reality is, over the last few budgets, we have cut so significantly and so substantially that it will cost future legislators just to dig us out of the holes we're putting ourselves in.
Rothfuss cites delayed maintenance and prevention programs as issues that will cost the state down the line. Rothfuss is also worried that the slight revenue increase will keep legislators from passing what he calls needed revenue increases to make up for the downturn in the energy economy.
There will be legislators that will look at the CREG report and feel that things are turning around, and if we just wait, it'll all be better. The Craig Group did not say that at any point in the report. When they project out into the future, they project a flat future.
Craig co-chairman Alex Keene agrees with that, to a point. He says the energy industry is not likely to rebound soon, with one possible exception.
The place where we see there is some opportunity for improvement is really in the oil sector. Looking at oil production numbers, we could see some volatility there to the positive. So any additional production could generate some additional returns to the state that are not forecast in this.
Governor Meade says this backs up his efforts to try to enhance Wyoming's economy through diversification. Despite some of the optimism, House Appropriations Chairman Bob Nicholas admits he's still concerned.
Not having enough revenue scares me.
The governor will present his proposed budget to the legislature's Joint Appropriations Committee in December. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
A draft of the Interior Department's five-year strategic plan has been leaked. The 50-page document draws a roadmap for the federal agency to prioritize energy dominance, with few mentions of conservation and no mention of climate change, both departures from the last strategic plan. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim speaks to Jesse Prentice Dunn, advocacy director to the Center for Western Priorities, a conservation nonprofit, about what else stands out in the five-year plan.
What is the five-year strategic plan for the DOI?
So yesterday we saw a leaked copy of the department's five-year strategic vision. This is something that every administration does. Each 5 years, it's kind of a roadmap for where the agency is going to go. And this document is a pretty clear summation of the Zinke doctrine, where he wants to see this go. And a read through the document shows that that prioritizes oil and gas development and treats our parks and visitors as burdens.
Okay, so let's get into some of what was in this document that struck you as leaning more towards oil and gas than, say, conservation.
So the document lays out a set of goals, strategies, and key performance indicators that they want to judge their performance on. And it's really notable when it comes to oil and gas that the indicators seek to maximize the sheer number of acres leased for oil and gas. We're not talking just about speeding up permitting, but actually maximizing the amount of land that's leased for energy development. And at the same time, not talking about raising antiquated royalty rates that have been shortchanging taxpayers. I'd note that even Wyoming has a higher royalty rate than the federal government, getting a better deal for Wyoming taxpayers. And so while this plan seeks to have more drilling, it's doing nothing to ensure taxpayers get more money.
Okay, so can you talk a little bit about those royalty rates? They were higher and they want to make them lower?
They just want to keep them the same. But the real juxtaposition here is when it comes to our national parks. The same document has a goal of raising national park entrance fees and putting more of a burden on the backs of national parks visitors, something they're not asking of oil and gas companies. Also, at the same time, the plan advocates for privatizing national park operations and increasing the amount of private investment in those parks. So I think there's a real double standard here, and that's pretty clear.
Yeah, so can you explain what privatizing national parks means?
So Ryan Zinke has spent the first months of his tenure as secretary really touting the benefits of privatizing park operations. So we're talking about turning over campgrounds to private operators, having contractors run restaurants there, installing Wi-Fi. He even compares it to getting in-flight Wi-Fi on your airplane. So instead of managing national parks for the public good, really turning them into profit machines for private companies.
And how likely is something like that to actually happen, do you think?
I think it's certainly possible that it will happen in the future, and it will certainly take time and processes to enact them. But the secretary is really pushing this effort to privatize services, and so I see it not going away anytime soon.
All right, let's jump back to the idea of prioritizing oil and gas development. Some of what was in the leaked document talking about lifting the coal moratorium that Obama had implemented or changing the sage-grouse plans, as we've seen in the past few months?
The document does, at a very high level, talk about placing an import or a priority of repealing, rolling back, eliminating, modifying pretty much any regulation they can think of that industry does not like. And so as a part of that, you see them advocating for lifting the coal leasing moratorium, moving to scrap sage-grouse plans. Pretty much anything they can think of, they want to eliminate.
Which is strange, considering public lands are really meant for multi-use, right? Conservation, recreation, and development.
Exactly. Secretary Zinke falls all over himself to talk about having multiple uses on our public lands. And this document really shows that, in his mind, multiple uses means oil development and gas development. So we're not talking about real balance here.
Okay. I guess with something like this five-year plan, do you have any idea how likely it is that it could change, or can the public rely on this general outline going forward?
I think this outline is pretty much what we're going to see when it's finalized. You know, there's certainly some placeholders, there's room for change, but it's not unexpected. It's not a departure from what we've seen from this Interior Department in the last few months, more just a continuation for the next 5 years. So we can definitely expect this to come true.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us. That was Jesse Prentice Dunn, Advocacy Director with Center for Western Priorities.
When we come back, Wyoming's congressional delegation talks about the GOP tax plan. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. Wyoming's lawmakers in the nation's capital are trying to help their party deliver on its promise to overhaul the nation's tax code. Correspondent Matt Laszlo reports from Washington that the effort is testing party unity and is far from certain.
Wyoming Senior Senator Mike Genzi took the lead last week as he helped his party take its first steps to tax reform by passing a budget blueprint that allows the GOP to overhaul the tax code without any Democratic support. As chair of the Budget Committee, Genzi led the fight to pass the budget on the Senate floor.
It's crucial that Congress approve this fiscal framework in order to eliminate the dated and stifling tax policies that are holding back American investments and productivity.
The last time lawmakers reformed the tax code was 1986. Enzi says it's long overdue.
Just think how much has changed in the country and the world in those 31 years, including our tax code. America's tax laws are incredibly complicated and work to slow our economy and hurt American families. Incredibly, our current tax system actually benefits foreign-based companies while harming U.S.-headquartered companies and employers.
As chair of the Budget Committee, Enzi squares off against Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, who Democrats tapped to lead the panel for them. The self-described socialist blasted the GOP proposal that independent analysts report would mean a tax cut for the wealthiest Americans, while also meaning higher taxes for many in the middle class. Sanders says it's the wrong approach.
The Republican budget is the Robin Hood principle in reverse. Robin Hood took from the rich and gave to the poor. What this budget does is take from working people, the middle class, the elderly, and the poor to give massive tax breaks to people who are already living in incredible opulence.
The GOP budget opens the door for them to cut taxes by as much as $1.5 trillion over a decade, which even some Republican critics say will cause the deficit to balloon up. For Sanders, it shows the GOP isn't focused on the most vulnerable Americans.
Republicans are now pushing one of the most destructive and unfair budget and tax proposals in the modern history of the United States, a plan that would do incalculable harm to tens of millions of working families, our children, the sick, the elderly, and the poor.
Enzi disputes that. He says the tax reform package is needed because former President Barack Obama and Democrats never got the nation back on track after the economic collapse that happened under former President George W. Bush.
I'm proud that Congress and the President are tackling these important issues. After 8 years of stagnant growth, it's clear that our nation needs a simpler, fairer, and more transparent tax system that will leave more dollars in the pockets of hardworking families.
The effort to reform taxes is getting more attention after the GOP failed to follow through on their promise to repeal and replace Obamacare. That's partly why Wyoming Congresswoman Liz Cheney says it's a must-pass effort.
And it's crucial for the party, but it's also crucial for the country and for the economy.
With Republican leaders still drafting their tax plan, they're hearing input from every direction as they look to find revenue to pay for it. Cheney says Wyoming fossil fuel companies could be helped out if the GOP stops propping up the renewable industry with tax subsidies.
What they can't do is be asked to compete when, you know, the renewable industry has been getting subsidies that have basically kept them alive.
But Democrats and some Republicans say that should be a non-starter. California Democrat John Garamendi says the GOP is misguided for even considering ending tax breaks for green energy.
Well, I am not surprised that they would do such a stupid thing. The future lies in green technologies. It is the new industry. It is the new opportunity for energy production. One that is cheaper, it's renewable.
But tax reform is hard because every part of the tax code seems to have a team of lobbyists or interest groups lining up to protect their pet deduction. Cheney says that's exactly why her party needs to simplify the tax code.
Part of the reason why there are so many different interest groups involved is because the way the tax code has been developed, you've got all sorts of special interests. The code itself, as you know, is so complicated that, you know, over the years, people have created loopholes and special rules for you know, different circumstances.
But already, Republican leaders seem opposed to President Trump's call to protect deductions for 401k accounts. But Cheney sides with the president.
We'll see where that comes out. I mean, my own personal view is that, you know, we ought to be encouraging savings. I think that we ought to allow people to have pre-tax money go into savings.
While Republicans are united in wanting to cut taxes, regional disputes over which deductions to keep and which to end are making it challenging to string together all the votes needed in Congress. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Women engineers face a lot of challenges, some of which begin as early as their college education, where they're highly outnumbered by their male peers in the classroom. To address this disparity, the University of Wyoming has launched a new mentoring program that pairs female engineering undergraduates with female alumni working in the field. Wyoming Public Radio's Maggie Mullen spoke with Teddy Friedman, a senior coordinator for UW's College of Engineering that's heading up the new program.
I immediately noticed that first started my position with the College of Engineering, only 18% of our college is of our student population is female. So immediately, you know, I asked the question, why? Because it seemed like, you know, we have a supportive community here at UW. And so I was wondering, you know, why aren't we seeing more women?
I understand that your primary duties at the College of Engineering is outreach. You visit K through 12 students across the state and lead engineering activities. So how did this particular mentor program come about?
2 years ago, I was a part of a Martin Luther King Days of Dialogue program, and I worked with one of our graduate students to create a space for all students, faculty, and staff within the College of Engineering and other STEM fields to come to the table and share out how they could be better supported in STEM, because we felt like we can't seem to identify a specific reason why we're not seeing more women or other underrepresented groups. And so what came from that program, we found a common theme was the need for more mentorship opportunities. And we are happy, actually, to involve our alumni because it seems like they're an underutilized resource. We have amazing alumni here at the university. And, you know, during this homecoming week, I think we thank and celebrate the community that we have, you know, existing on campus. And they seem passionate about encouraging our students to be successful in their careers.
And what is it like for these female undergraduates at UW studying engineering?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I've actually, you know, gotten some feedback from our students. You know, they've mentioned that it's a challenge when you show up and you're one of two females in a class to then feel like, you know what, I have a voice here. I feel confident in sharing my opinion. I know that's been a struggle in the past. And my hope is that with this program, they can feel confident sharing a question they might have or sharing an experience that they might have with the hopes of then there's going to be more women at the table later on.
So this program is geared towards helping female undergraduates succeed in both school and in their careers. Do any of those efforts include encouraging them to stay in Wyoming after they graduate?
The fact that we're involving women who, alumni who, for the most part, they all but one live within the state. And so I think that automatically lends itself to show, you know, you can be a successful female in engineering in the state of Wyoming. I know that the university and specifically the College of Engineering would like to continue to create, you know, jobs that keep our students here and help our community thrive.
So women in engineering or just generally in STEM face a lot of issues. Will this program tackle specific ones?
My vision, I think, for the program at this point is really trying to build a better sense of community. Not necessarily a better sense, but a stronger sense of community just at UW. And especially, you know, going back to the question you had about encouraging women to stay in the state, I think there's a lot of opportunity in the state of Wyoming to have an awesome career. And so I think at this point, this program will kind of touch upon that. So creating this strong sense of community and connection to this place and to encourage these women to be successful and, you know, to work through those barriers or the challenges that might arise in their personal and professional life. And I think that one-on-one interaction can inspire a sense of groundedness and help those young women build confidence so that, you know, no matter where they are, they can be successful. But I think, you know, forming that community here just creates a more welcoming environment.
One last question for you, Teddy. A lot of students graduate from UW's College of Engineering. It's one of the largest schools on campus. So some people might say, you know, so what to this program? So I wanted to ask you, what's the importance of diversifying this field?
You know, when everyone has a voice and has a seat at the table, we can better reflect the values of the people in our community in this place. And when we reflect the values, then we are creating programs that serve our community and ultimately lead to innovation and lead to new thinking and the creation of projects and prototypes, you know, specifically thinking engineering, lead to the creation of new ideas that will serve the people in Wyoming and then nationally as well.
Well, thank you so much for your time today, Teddy.
Yeah, thank you, Maggie.
That was UW's Teddy Friedman speaking with Wyoming Public Radio's Maggie Mullen about the launch of a new mentoring program for undergraduate women studying engineering at UW.
When we come back, a sexual assault survivor discusses her experience telling that story to the University of Wyoming, and a wildlife photographer documents migration. This is Open Spaces.
This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. It's only been in the last few years that scientists have realized that pronghorn, elk, and mule deer are migrating rugged terrain over hundreds of miles to reach the best grazing around Yellowstone and Grand Teton National Parks. It is almost impossible to conceive what these animals endure on those journeys. But that's what wildlife photographer Joe Reese set out to document through pictures. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards talked to him about his new book, Yellowstone Migrations, and how he got into photography in the first place.
I grew up in South Dakota, and I grew up in a family who hunted for our food, you know, pheasants and deer, and that's really where my fascination with wildlife started. And then I went to school at the University of Wyoming, and then that's when I really got into the wildlife science and got interested in wildlife research.
Yeah. And so you came to the university, and there was the beginnings of this new understanding of how vast these migrations were. How did you end up getting involved in finding your way into wanting to take photographs and document that?
You know, my first action, I guess, was just to look up on Google and see, see what the migrations look like, you know, just because I couldn't really have that picture in my mind of what these animals look like when they were migrating. And at the time, there just wasn't any images of them. No one had put in the time, I mean, to really document that process of migration. So that's what I set out to do, is make the first pictures of that pronghorn antelope migration from the Tetons down into southwestern Wyoming.
What was your vision for a better way to capture what those animals experience and put people in the place of the animal and give them a sense of what they go through on these migrations?
Yeah, so the pictures that I saw that were captioned migration, you know, for the most part, they were animals grouped up and they were running away from something. And I guess I knew that that's not what migration is. I mean, I don't think animals, you know, are running full speed like that during migration. So I needed to figure out, you know, first of all, what migration looks like. And then I needed to figure out how to photograph it. So, you know, the first thing I realized, I guess, was that I was having an impact on the migration. You know, that these animals were seeing me, they were sensing me well before I saw them. So that's when I started to learn how to use camera traps. So, you know, just a normal camera that I set up, but except that I'm not there, and animals trigger the camera through motion. So, and that kind of gives me the opportunity to put the camera in the most ideal place that I can imagine. So, you know, right alongside the trail, kind of at a low angle, so it feels like you're sitting there with the animals, and then also I can lessen my impact. So that's really what I did for the majority of 2 years. I set up cameras along the different pronghorn trails with the goal of showing them migrating. One thing I also wanted to do was show some of the threats to the migration. So, you know, the roads and the fences and the housing developments. And the camera traps really allowed me to show, you know, the problems with fences.
And once you got into documenting the experience of, for instance, elk and deer, and realizing that they were making these journeys into some real wilderness, well, then that took you into this wilderness. How did you get out there? What was your life like trying to capture this journey?
Well, at the beginning, it was very lonely because I was working solo, you know, and so for the pronghorn and the mule deer work, that's mostly in the upper Green River Basin, so I was driving. I was mostly living in the back of my truck. And then for the elk work, which has been this past 4 years, that is mainly over in Cody in this the southern Absorcas. And that's all backcountry work, so it's all horse and mule. And so that's, you know, much more wilderness experience. I'm working directly with the outfitters in the Cody area, you know, living in wall tents, that type of thing.
Do you mind telling me, you know, just some of anecdotes about capturing some of your favorite photographs?
It's like Christmas, I guess, looking in the back of the camera, you know, to see what I got. You know, probably my favorite image now is it's a picture of an elk calf following its mother up a 11,000 foot slope on its first migration. It's about 3 weeks old, its mouth is open. It just got done swimming the South Fork of the Shoshone River. You know, it is what migration look. I mean, that is the essence of migration. You know, it's all about the calves, really. And that was a spot that I found in 2014. And then I worked that spot for 2 months during the spring migration, and I didn't get the picture I wanted. So I returned back in 2015 and was there that whole summer as well. And then I think it was like July 14th, I showed up to the camera, and that's a camera that's about 8 miles from the trailhead. So it's all horse and mule. In to check the camera, and I checked it, and at 10 in the morning, a few days prior, there was a large group of cows and calf elk, and they passed right by my camera, and there was a whole bunch of calves in the herd, and they had their mouths open. It was a hot summer morning, and just right there I knew that was the one frame that will become, you know, my favorite picture of the whole project, and it has been.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards speaking with wildlife photographer Joe Reese.
The hashtag MeToo started flooding social media following the news about Harvey Weinstein. But the campaign has extended beyond women in Hollywood, inspiring millions of people to speak out about their experiences with sexual harassment and assault. In our ongoing series about campus sexual misconduct, education reporter Tennessee Watson takes a look at what happens when students come forward at the University of Wyoming.
Halloween is a holiday Sarah Jackson Weber wishes she could forget. In 2015, Weber was a freshman looking forward to 4 years as a kinesiology major and a future in medicine. But that all shifted, Weber says, when she was assaulted following a Halloween party.
I kind of knew what I wanted to do before, and now I'm kind of unsure as to what career path to take. But I just chose the degree that would get me out the fastest.
Weber's right to pursue an education is protected by a federal guideline called Title IX. If sexual harassment or violence interferes with a student's ability to learn, schools are expected to intervene. But Weber doesn't feel the University of Wyoming met its obligation to support her. She says she spent the day following the assault alone in her room, feeling in shock.
I was just sitting there being like, oh, it was fine, and trying to say, oh, he would never like purposefully hurt me like that. And it was probably just a big misunderstanding, and I'm probably just blowing things out of the water.
But the bruises on her legs and her ripped underwear and tights made the reality of what happened hard to ignore. She texted him, hoping he'd listen and acknowledge the harm he'd done.
And he just like lashed out and replied with stuff like, it was your fault, you wanted it. And that's why I decided to report, because it was obvious that he felt no remorse.
Given the fact that we've heard from droves of women over the last few weeks who waited years to come forward about sexual abuse, it would seem that Weber acted impressively fast. Less than 2 weeks after the assault, she went to see Megan Selheim at Stop Violence, the office on campus that supports sexual assault survivors.
And she strongly encouraged me to report to the university instead of reporting to the Laramie police, so I took her advice.
Weber made a report to the Dean of Students' office, but she says Sean Blackburn, who was the Dean of Students at the time, and Assistant Dean Nicole Courtney, made her feel like an inconvenience.
I just felt like they didn't want to have to deal with it, like they were kind of brushing it under the rug and putting it off.
Weber says after the initial interviews in November and December, she stopped hearing from the Dean of Students' office. Finally, on February 26th, she heard from Dean Blackburn again.
And that's because my parents didn't complain about how long it was taking until February 8th.
I reached out to Blackburn, who is now the vice president of student affairs, to ask about those gaps in communication. He told me he can't speak to specifics on individual cases. One of Weber's biggest complaints is with the report she received from the Dean of Students at the conclusion of the investigation. We flipped through it together. The document lays out testimony from Weber, the accused, and 5 witnesses, only one of whom was actually at the party where the incident occurred. Weber reads me the conclusion.
Based on a preponderance of the evidence, there is no violation of UW Regulation 1-256, policies and procedures governing sexual misconduct.
In other words, Nicole Courtney, the investigator, didn't find enough evidence to say with certainty what happened. And Weber feels like that sent the message that what happened was okay.
So that's obviously hard to read.
And there was no warning that the summary contained disrespectful and degrading material, according to Weber. She reads me a statement from one of the witnesses, relaying a comment made by the perpetrator.
If Sarah was to wear a slut outfit, he would have to make a move.
But what really floored Weber was the unprofessional nature of the document composed by Nicole Courtney.
That is not how you spell that kid's name, and she spells my name wrong a bunch of times. And I just think that that's another way of showing, like, lack of care, is that they just kind of threw it all together.
Sometimes her name is misspelled within the same paragraph. Quotes in the report are also confusing because it's unclear who is saying them. But even when investigations go well, it's still a hard process.
There were things that I didn't love about it, obviously. I was so sick of it, and I felt like it really was a long time. But I got that closure.
That's Emily Alexander, who we spoke to in a previous story on sexual assault prevention. When her perpetrator was finally expelled, she says feeling like UW had her back renewed her sense of safety and self-confidence.
And I wish everyone could have that, like, relief, because I know it's not like that for most people that I've heard their situation.
Megan Selheim from Stop Violence says it's important what students are saying to each other about these cases.
A survivor might talk to their roommate and say, this thing happened to me last week and I don't know what to do. And that roommate can either say, oh my gosh, the same thing happened to a friend of mine last year. They told the school and the school took care of them. Or that roommate can say, oh my gosh, the same thing happened to a friend of mine last year. They told the school and it was terrible.
Selheim says the more consistent and supportive the process, the more likely survivors are to report. But going by Alexander and Weber's perceptions, the university isn't consistent. But what do the numbers say? Over a month ago, I asked Sean Blackburn for data on how many reports lead to investigations, how many result in hearings, and how many end up in violations.
So here's what I got for you.
In 2014, there were 13 reports of sexual misconduct resulting in 4 violations. Every year since then, reports have gone up, jumping to 77, but there were still just 4 violations. And the more nuanced data, like how many victims decided not to pursue an investigation, or how many times the dean of students' office said there was not enough evidence, will take more time to pull together, Blackburn says.
There's a ton more data that we will continue to need to work on that'll help us make decisions about how we move forward.
But Weber, who is now a math major, doesn't need to see the numbers. What she's lived through is evidence enough that the process needs improvements. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Tennessee Watson.
The Buffalo Bills Center of the West is in the midst of a major upgrade of the Cody Firearms Museum. The museum's Robert W. Woodruff curator, Ashley Lubinsky, says it's more than just a Western firearms museum.
We certainly got our roots with the American West, with the gun that won the West, the Winchester Arms Collection. We originally called the Winchester Arms Museum. But we have guns dating all the way back to the 1400s. We've got crossbows from the 1200s. And we go all the way up to modern manufacture. I think our most recent manufactured firearm is a Winchester from 2016.
What do you find that people maybe don't realize about firearms when we look at our American history?
I think a lot of people don't realize how diverse the stories are around firearms and how firearms have been made for so many different reasons throughout history, and that you can pretty much take a firearm as an object and tell so many different stories about the Industrial Revolution or manufacturing or the people that made the gun, the people that owned the gun, military history. There's just so many things that you can unpack when you look at a firearm.
One of the reasons we have you on today is because you're doing some renovations and some upgrades, and you're really trying to make this an unbelievable museum. Talk about what you're doing.
The Cody Firearms Museum is no doubt a destination museum for gun enthusiasts. But because there are 4 other museums on site, we get a lot of people through the door that are on their way to Yellowstone. They're from all over the country or around the world, and they have an opportunity to wander into the firearms museums. And so the one thing we're trying to do in the museum, in the new museum, is balance the fact that we've got these two polar opposite audiences. You've got your gun enthusiasts, your collectors, but then you also have people that really may never have handled a gun before in their life, or they only know what they see in the movies. And so the current museum is set up very well for the collector experience. But one of the things that people who don't know a lot about guns struggle with when they come in is the why question. Why are there so many different kinds of guns? How did they work? Why are they important to American history, international history? And so the new museum balances the quantity by displaying lots of guns, but they also balance with the interpretation so that you can have a much richer takeaway from the firearms museums in terms of history when you leave the museum, especially since this may be the first and only time that people get an opportunity to learn about firearms and their historical context.
My understanding is you'll be displaying more firearms than we've been able to see in the past, and you're going to be doing some interactive things?
Correct. We believe that if you have an encyclopedic collection, then you should show it, and there's been a lot of developments in terms of case work since the museum opened in 1991. So we're experimenting with visible display, but then also if you've ever been to our museum, you know that we've got pull-out racks and visible storage downstairs. So we're exploring with some of that upstairs. So we do have the ability to display more firearms without it feeling like it's overwhelming. And then in terms of the interactive, The first thing you walk into when you come into the new museum is what I call, well, we're calling it a primer. If you know about guns, you may giggle at that. And so it brings people that might not know about guns up to speed. So that's where they can get hands-on. They'll learn about, you know, the basics of firearm safety. They'll learn about how to work a bolt action or how to work a lever action. And they'll be able to actually see those firearms and understand the basic principles and mechanics. They'll also have a chance, if they want, in our introductory area to learn how to sight a firearm or to grip, you know, a pistol or to shoulder a rifle. And then as you go into the gallery, we'll have videos so that if you're looking at a matchlock musket, you're not like, how the heck did that fire? You can actually watch a video to see the process of a matchlock musket firing or a wheel lock or a flintlock. So you can watch those videos.
So your time frame, you've been working on upgrading all along here for the last few months. What's next, and when do you hope to have this all done?
We have a projected opening of June 2019, and right now we are in the final stages of design development. And then by the end of January, that phase will be complete. We'll move into kind of the construction documentation side of it. And then by next fall, so that's fall of 2018, we hope to be working on the installation so that we can open up for the following season in 2019.
Ashley Lubinsky, we wish you well with all of this, and we'll look forward to chatting with you down the road. And thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
When we come back, we'll have a couple of Halloween stories for you. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. It's almost Halloween. Plastic tombstones and dancing skeletons are everywhere you look. But how does Wyoming handle actual death? Wyoming Public Radio's Annie Osborne spoke with someone whose job it was to be in the presence of the dead.
I'm talking today with Casey Vernon, who served as Albany County Coroner for 4 years. Casey, how did you get started in this field? What in your background prepared you for something like this?
So my mom was a homicide detective, and my father was in law enforcement too. So I kind of had this strange upbringing where forensics was a really big part of my life. And then I was in the anthropology program at the University of Wyoming, and I met the coroner at the time, Tom Ferguson, and basically hassled him until he, like, let me work for him.
Do you have a sense of why this is an elected position? Is there a lot of politics involved in this field?
Obviously, it's not a partisan position, although when I was running for office, I learned that people will make pretty much anything partisan if given the chance. The reason, though, or a reason that the coroner is an elected position is because one of the functions of the coroner's office is to, like, serve as a check on other branches of investigation. And also because historically people have been of the opinion that the person who decides what happens to your body when you die or what happens to, say, your stuff, that, like, any person should have some kind of say.
What did an average day look like?
There was definitely no such thing as an average day. I mean, there were tons and tons of days because this is a place with a pretty low population. You or the coroner doesn't have something to do every single day in terms of someone being deceased and having to respond to that.
For those of us who don't have that background with our parents investigating death, how is it different than what we see on CSI?
Many investigative departments are very underfunded. So the really cool technology that you see on CSI, A, usually doesn't necessarily exist in the first place, but even if it does, it's not. A lot of departments are in a situation where they're like, I hope we can afford plenty of gloves, let alone can we get a hologram? I worked for the medical examiner's office in Onondaga County, which is where Syracuse is in upstate New York. To a certain degree, we did get some results there more quickly than we would here because it's a really integrated office that has, like, their own lab facilities. But in a place like Albany County, where you're sending everything out, I mean, you're relying on another agency. So it can be very variable in how long it takes. It's definitely never 24 hours, though.
What was the strangest scene you were ever called out to?
I get asked a lot when I go out with friends or when I meet a new person, what's the weirdest thing you've ever seen, or what's the most interesting thing you've ever seen, or have you ever seen anything scary? And what I eventually started telling people was that everything I saw was really interesting and that I just didn't really think about it like that anymore, because the people that I was dealing with were, to me, real people. And it was oftentimes very sad or just at least very, very serious and very heavy.
A lot of times the family would be present. It's not kind of a barren crime scene.
Oh, yeah. Definitely much more often than not, there's at least one person, usually like quite a few people present, that will be interviewed and sometimes sort of advised by like the coroner or medical examiner's office.
What kind of questions would folks have?
By and large, people don't really know what happens after you die, and not like just in terms of, you know, is there an afterlife, but like, where does your body go? Then what happens? What do we do? Is there going to be an autopsy? Do I have to pay for an autopsy? Does my insurance have anything to do with this? What do I do with all of these legal issues?
What would be your biggest piece of advice for folks going through that situation where a loved one has just passed away?
I saw a lot of people who were intrinsically or by like their upbringing very strong, capable people trying to deal with this incredibly confusing, overwhelming situation on their own. And so at scenes, my staff and I would try to ask, is there somebody that we can call to be here with you? Because you're going to forget to drink water or that you need to go to bed at a certain point or to eat.
And would you serve as a point person after that initial meeting?
I hope so. I like to think that that was a big part of my job. I always made my contact information available, which sometimes resulted in, you know, like lots and lots of phone calls if people had lots of questions, or like phone calls at strange hours because I just gave everyone my cell phone number. The funny thing about being the coroner is people will just call you and ask you questions when they don't necessarily have a loved one who's recently deceased. They just are curious. Like, with an interesting level of frequency, get questions from people, like, usually about themselves, actually. Can I just get buried in, like, a cardboard box? Do I have to go through a funeral home? And usually my answer was, I don't know. You should maybe talk to a lawyer.
Did you notice any difference in the kind of questions people asked when you were in Syracuse versus things that might come up in Wyoming and in more rural areas?
Oh, yeah. Wyoming is a place where it's a little bit more acceptable to even have this, well, can I get buried in my own backyard kind of thought. That's not necessarily something that would occur to a lot of New Yorkers.
That was Casey Vernon, former Albany County coroner, sharing her experiences with the dead. Thank you so much, Casey. It's been great talking to you.
Thank you.
For the next phase in her career, Vernon wants to focus on a different part of the circle of life. She's studying to be a midwife.
Halloween is almost here, and so we'll leave you with one last ghost story. Birgit Burke has lived in a number of old houses in Laramie, but one experience in particular has stuck with her.
It was one house from the corner of 15th and Harney. It was very beat up. It was one of those houses where there were holes between the floorboards in the kitchen, and you could stick a knife down and hit dirt, you know, just a regular kitchen knife. So, like, a really crappy old house with no foundation and no insulation. It's the second house I've lived in Laramie that burned down after I moved out of it, and I'm not surprised that it burned. I don't know. I live in cheap houses, obviously. But it was right across from the graveyard on the other side of 15th. My oldest daughter, who was 4 or 5 at that time, she's always been, you know, just a little bit hooked into the supernatural, whatever. But she used to say all the time, she's like, she'd see people in her closet. I'm like, okay, fine, you know, not trying to scare you or anything like that. But she said she'd see ghosts in, like, period outfits for, you know, Frontier Laramie. And then one day, we saw this green ball of light come out of the wall and go down the hallway, through her bedroom, through the wall, out the other side. Actually, the next door neighbors saw it come out the other side, go across their yard, across their porch, and through their house, and it vanished. No, we moved out of it not long after that. I know. But there were 5 people saw it.
It sounds very Ghostbuster-y. Green
it's
ball
exactly
of light.
That color. You know? But there were no hot dogs, you know, like Slimer stuff going. Anyway, yeah, so that was that.
That story was produced by Wyoming Public Radio's Caroline Ballard. If you want more spooky stories, and who doesn't, listen to a special Halloween episode of Human Nature out now at humannaturepodcast.org or wherever you download your podcasts. Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. If you missed part of the show or want to hear it again, you can find it and individual segments on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org, and a rater is our web editor.
We always welcome good ideas for stories and interviews, so you can recommend them through our website or Wyoming Public Radio News Facebook page.
Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.